and a few loose sticks of gum and a lone fuzz-covered Mentos. No Xanax. I zip it shut. I'm not arguing, Sam says. No, you're suggesting. Me? Sam says, faux offended. I'm in no way suggesting that you want to get it on with that hot cop. I think you just did. All I'm saying is that he's hot. I never noticed. Sam pulls out a tube of gloss and gives one quick swipe to both her bottom and top lips. I called bullshit on that one, babe. It's kind of hard not to notice. Seriously, I never have. He saved my life. When someone does that, you tend not to think of them in that way. Guys do. They pretend they don't, but they totally do. Sam's taken on a wiser, worldlier tone. The older sister giving sex advice. I wonder what kind of men she dates. Older guys, probably. Bikers with thick chests and thicker guts, their beards peppered with gray. Or maybe she likes them younger. Pale, wiry men so inexperienced, they're grateful for even the most disinterested of hand jobs. If he did, I say, Coop's too much of a gentleman to make a big deal out of it. Gentleman? Sam says. He's a cop. From my experience, they fuck like jackhammers. I say nothing, knowing how she's only looking for my disapproval, seeking a chance to chide me for being such a prude. Janelle did it all the time. I'm joking, she says. Lighten up. That was another of Janelle's traits. To backtrack once she knew she'd gone too far, trying to shrug everything off as a joke. Today, Sam does her one better. I'm sorry, Quinn. I'll tone it down. Really. Her hand plunges into her pocket. By the way, I thought you might like this. Something for your goodie drawer. She pulls out a Mont Blanc pen as sleek and shiny as a silver bullet and presses it into my hand. It once belonged to the writer in the cafe. Now it belongs to us. Another one of our shared secrets.
Pine Cottage, 6:58 p.m. They were forced to dress for dinner. Another one of Janelle's rules. Before they left, she made sure to check that everyone brought the proper attire. Slobs will be sent home, she warned. Quincy had packed two dresses, the only two she brought with her to college. Both had been picked out by her mother, who had harbored dreams of Quincy going to mixers and pledging sororities just as she had done. One dress was black, which Quincy had thought would be fine for the occasion. In the wan light of the cabin, though, it looked more widow at a funeral than Audrey Hepburn in Breakfast at Tiffany's. That left the blue one, which appeared dowdier than she intended. I look dumpy, Quincy said. She knew she was right, because Janelle looked more horrified than when she'd sliced her finger half an hour earlier. She now pointed it at Quincy, band-aid crinkling. Worse, she said. You look like a virgin. That's not a bad thing, you know. It is if you're trying to get some. Craig knows it will be my first time. Which that dress makes glaringly obvious, Janelle said, eyeing her from head to foot. I have an idea. She opened one of her two suitcases and tossed something at Quincy. It was a dress, white silk, as cool and shimmering as a swimming pool. Isn't white, like, the most virginal color? Quincy asked. The color of the dress says virgin, but the cut says sex. It's the best of both worlds. Craig will love it. Quincy rolled her eyes. Typical Janelle, who had been obsessed with the Madonna whore complex ever since they learned about it in Psych 101. What are you going to wear? Janelle turned back to her suitcase. I brought extras, of course. Of course. Quincy held the dress against her body, examining it in the room's grimy square of a mirror. The cut, with its plunging bodice and asymmetrical skirt, looked a little too sexy for her taste. Even with her back turned, Janelle could sense her hesitation. "Just try it on, Quinn." Quincy slid out of the blue dress, which gave Janelle the opportunity to take a disapproving look at her bra and panties. Mismatched and worn, they were the antithesis of sexy. "God, Quinn, really? Did you not plan any aspect of this weekend?" "No," Quincy said, holding the recently removed blue dress to her chest, trying to hide behind it. "Because planning puts pressure on something, and I don't want any pressure. Whatever Craig and I do this weekend, I want it to happen naturally." Janelle gave a sisterly smile and brushed a strand of blonde hair from Quincy's face. "It's okay to be nervous." "I'm not nervous." Quincy grimaced at the anxious quiver in her voice. "I'm just inexperienced. What if I'm lousy at sex?" That's one way to put it." "You won't know until you try it," Janelle said. "What if Craig doesn't like it?" Quincy thought back to what Janelle had said earlier, about Craig having plenty of options besides her. She knew all too well about the cheerleaders who fawned over him after games and the fangirls in school colors who yelled his name in the quad. They would be all too willing to take Quincy's place if Craig was disappointed in her. "He'll like it," Janelle said. "He's a guy, after all." "What if I don't like it?" "You will. It just takes some getting used to." Quincy felt a flutter in her stomach, more than a butterfly, a bird flapping. "How much getting used to?" "It'll be fine," Janelle assured her. "Now, show me how that dress looks on you." Quincy slid on the dress, the white silk tickling her bare legs. As she tugged and adjusted it over her shoulder, Janelle said, "What do you think of Joe? He's kind of hot, right?"
"More like creepy," Quincy said.
"He's mysterious."
"Which is practically the same as creepy."
"Well, I think he's mysterious. And hot."
"And taken," Quincy added. "You're forgetting the girlfriend."
Now it was Janelle's turn to roll her eyes. "Whatever."
"I just want to state for the record that the rest of us don't want him here. We're only letting him stay because it's your birthday."
"Duly noted," Janelle said. "And don't worry, I plan on keeping him very entertained." Done with wrangling into the dress, Quincy backed up to Janelle, who zipped her up. Both of them examined her reflection in the mirror. Although the dress was tighter than Quincy normally liked, Janelle was right. She looked sexy.
"Wow," she said.
Janelle Wolf whistled. "You look so good, I might even try to fuck you."
"Thanks, I think."
Janelle made a few adjustments, giving a tight tug of the hem before smoothing some fabric bunched at Quincy's shoulders. "Perfect."
"You think?"
Quincy asked, despite already knowing that it was, indeed, perfect. Yet something still bothered her.
"What's wrong?" Janelle asked. "It's going to hurt, isn't it?"
"Yes," Janelle said, sighing out the word. "It does, but it also feels good."
"Which will I feel more of, the bad or the good?"
"That's the weird part. They're one and the same." Quincy looked in the mirror, zeroing in on the eyes of her reflection, uneasy at the fear she saw in them.
"You sure?"
"Trust me." Janelle wrapped her arms around Quincy, hugging her from behind. "Would I ever lead you astray?"
16. Coop insists on walking us back to my place, even though Sam and I are perfectly capable of taking care of ourselves. Last night made that abundantly clear. Sam walks alongside him, matching his pace stride by careful stride. I lag behind, my face lifted to the sun. It's a bright, hot afternoon, the last kiss of Indian summer before winter begins its slow takeover. The bruise on my face pulses a little, warmed by the sunlight. I picture it reddening into visibility along my skin. I want Coop to turn around, finally notice it, widen his eyes in concern. But he stays two steps ahead with Sam, their strides still matching as they round the corner onto 82nd Street. Both of them immediately stop. I do too. Something is going on outside my building. A horde of reporters has gathered there, so large and unruly we can see them from two blocks away. Coop? My voice is weak, an echo of its normal self. Something's wrong. No shit, Sam says.
Stay calm, Coop says. We don't know for certain why they're here.
Yet I know. They're here for us. I reach into my purse and grab my phone, which I turned off when Sam and I left the apartment. It springs to life with an explosion of alerts. Missed calls, missed emails, missed texts. Worry numbs my hands as I scroll through them. Many numbers I don't recognize, which means they're from reporters. Only Jonah Thompson's is familiar to me. He called three times. We should walk away, I say, knowing it will be only another minute or so before we're spotted, or get a cab. And go where? Sam asks. I don't know. Jeff's office? Central Park? Anywhere but here.
That's not a bad idea, Coop says. It'll give us time to find out what's going on.
And they can't stay out here forever. I squint at the crowd up the street, which seems to have grown in the past 30 seconds. Can they?
I'm not waiting that long, Sam mutters.
She sets off up the street, marching straight for the reporters. I manage to grab the back of her blouse and tug, trying to hold her in place. But it's no use. The silk slips from my fingers. Do something, I tell Coop. He watches her advance, blue eyes narrowed. I can't tell if he's worried or impressed. Maybe it's a little of both. All I feel, however, is worry, which is why I rush after Sam, catching up just as she reaches my block. The reporters see us, of course, their heads turning toward us more or less at the same time. A flock of buzzards spotting fresh roadkill. The TV people have cameramen with them who jostle one another for prime position. The still photographers duck beneath them, shutters clacking. Jonah Thompson is among them. No surprise there. He, like the other reporters, barks our first names as we approach, as if he knows us. As if he cares. Quincy! Samantha! We fall back a few steps, accosted on all sides by the surge of cameras and microphones. A hand lands on my shoulder, heavy and strong. I don't even need to look back to know it belongs to Coop, finally joining us.
Come on, guys, step aside, he tells the reporters. Let them get through.
Sam pushes forward, swinging her arms back and forth to clear a path, not caring who she hits.
Get the fuck out of our fucking way, she says, knowing how all that swearing will prevent the footage from being used on newscasts. We've fucking got nothing to fucking say to you.
So that's no comment? Asks one reporter.
He's a TV guy, the camera behind him swiveling towards Sam like the eye of an angry cyclops.
Sounds that fucking way to me.
She turns away from him, looking to me instead. All those flashbulbs give her face a luminescent glow. The light flattens her features, making her expression as pale and blank as a full moon. On the edge of my vision, I see Jonah nudge his way toward me.
You're really not going to say anything about Lisa Milner? He says.
Curiosity stirs in me, pushing me forward. Lisa's suicide happened days ago. In a 24-hour news cycle, that's an eternity. This is something else. Something new.
What about Lisa?
I say, sweeping in close. Cameras fill the spot I just vacated, surrounding me.
She didn't kill herself, Jonah says. Her death's been ruled a homicide. Lisa Milner was murdered.
These are the details. On the night she died, Lisa Milner consumed 2 glasses of Merlot. She did not drink alone. Someone else was with her, also drinking wine. That same someone spiked Lisa's glass with a large quantity of anatrophilin, a mighty antidepressant sometimes used as a sleep aid for the seriously traumatized. Lisa had enough in her system to put an adult male gorilla into a coma. The wine and anatrophilin were discovered during the toxicology tests performed in the wake of Lisa's death. Without them, everyone would have continued to think she killed herself. Even with them, it would have appeared that way. The responding officers found more anatrophilin on the kitchen counter. What they couldn't find was a bottle or a prescription from Lisa's doctor. But that means nothing in an age of online pharmacies that charge 3 times the going rate for pills shipped from Canada. Any drug your pharmaceutical-deprived heart desires is just a border hop away. After the tox report lit up like a Vegas casino, a CSI unit was again dispatched to Lisa's house. They took the closer look they should have done days earlier but hadn't bothered to because everyone thought she had offed herself. They found Lisa's wine glass, its bottom crusted with granules of anatrophilin. They found 2 rings of dried Merlot on the dining room table, created by the bottoms of 2 wine glasses. 1 wine ring contained anatrophilin. The other did not. What they couldn't find was that 2nd glass, or any signs of struggle, or forced entry. Lisa had trusted whoever killed her. The medical examiner noticed something strange about the cuts on Lisa's wrists. They were deeper than most self-inflicted knife wounds, especially if the person doing the cutting was drugged out of her mind. Even more telling was the direction of each cut, from right to left on Lisa's left wrist and left to right on her right one. In most cases, the opposite is the norm. And even though Lisa might have been able to slash herself in such an unusual manner, the angle of the wounds proved otherwise. There was no way she could have caused those cuts. Someone had done it to her. The same person who put pills in her wine and later took the glass with them. The big question mark, other than who did it and why, of course, is when Lisa made the 911 call on her cell phone. Authorities in Muncie suspect it was after the drugging but before the cutting. Their theory is that Lisa realized she had been drugged and managed to call 911. Her assailant took the phone from her before she got the chance to speak and hung up. Knowing the police would be coming anyway, that person grabbed a knife, dragged a groggy Lisa to the bathtub, and sliced. It also explains why her wrists were slit when, in all likelihood, the anatrophilin would have killed her on its own. What the police don't know, until they find it on Lisa's computer hard drive, is that she sent me an email roughly an hour before all this happened. It jumps into my thoughts as we gather around Coop's cell phone, set to speaker so all of us can hear the details.
Quincy, I need to talk to you. It's extremely important. Please, please don't ignore this.
We're in the dining room. Me standing at the head of the table, too restless with anger and heartbreak to sit down. Lisa is still dead. This new revelation doesn't change that. But it does leave me grieving in a new, slightly raw way. Murder is a stranger beast than suicide, although the end result of both is the same. Even the words themselves differ. Suicide hisses like a snake, a sickness of the mind and soul. Murder, though, makes me think of sludge, dark and thick and filled with pain. Lisa's death was easier to deal with when I thought it was suicide. It meant that ending her life was her decision. That, right or not, it had been her choice. There is no choice in murder. Coop and Sam appear equally as stunned. They sit on opposite sides of the table, silent and still. Because he's never been in the apartment before, Coop's presence adds an extra layer of weirdness to what's already a surreal situation. It's jarring to see him in civilian clothes, uncomfortable in a dainty dining room chair. Like he's not the real Coop, but an imposter, lurking in a place he doesn't belong. The fake, cheery Sam, meanwhile, has been left behind at the cafe. Now it's the real one who gnaws her fingernails to the quick while staring at Coop's phone, as if she can see the person talking through it and not the featureless silhouette currently filling the screen. The voice we hear belongs to Coop's acquaintance in the Indiana State Police. Her name is Nancy, and she was a first responder to the sorority house after Stephen Liebman finished his bloody spree. She was also Lisa's version of Coop. "I'm not going to lie to you all," she says in a voice made low by exhaustion and grief. "They've got very little to work with here." I can only half hear her because the email plays on a loop in my mind, read aloud in Lisa's voice. "Quincy, I need to talk to you." Things might be different if those numbnuts had searched her place the minute they found her body, like I told them to do. But they didn't, and God knows how many people tramped through there before they did. The whole scene is compromised, Frank. Fingerprints all over the place.
It's extremely important.
So they might never know who did it? Coop asks. I never say never, Nancy says. But right now, it's not looking too good. A brief silence follows in which all four of us think about the very real possibility of never getting more answers than what we already know. No killer brought to justice. No motive. No definitive reason why Lisa sent me an email not long before taking that first unknowing sip of doom.
Please, please don't ignore this.
Another thought slithers into my head, sinuous and alarming.
Should Sam and I be worried?
I ask. Coop scrunches his brow, pretending the thought hadn't occurred to him when, of course, it had.
Well, I say.
I don't think there's cause for worry, he says. Do you, Nancy?
Nancy's wan voice emerges from the phone. There's nothing to suggest this has anything to do with what happened to all of you.
But what if it might? I say.
Quincy?
Coop gives me a look I've never seen before. There's a sternness to it, mingling with disappointment that I might be hiding something from him.
What aren't you telling me?
Something I should have told him days earlier. I didn't, because it seemed like Lisa's email was a desperate attempt to be talked out of killing herself. Now I know differently. Now I suspect that Lisa was really trying to warn me. About what? I have no idea. I got an email from Lisa, I announce. Sam at last looks up from the phone, hand still at her mouth, the nail of her ring finger grasped between her teeth.
What?
When? Coop says, concern burning bright in his eyes. The night she died. About an hour before, to be exact.
Tell me what it said, he says, every word.
I tell them everything. The contents of the email. When I received it. When I actually read it. I even try to explain why I waited so long to tell anyone but Jeff about it, although Coop doesn't really care why. His only focus is the fact he didn't know about it sooner.
You should have told me the second you got it, Quincy.
I know, I say.
This could have changed things.
I know that, Coop. It could have given the police a reason for doing a better search of Lisa's house, leading them to sooner conclude that she was murdered. It might have even yielded an important clue into who killed her. I know all of this, and the guilt it spawns makes me angry. At myself. At Lisa's killer. Even at Lisa for thrusting me into this position. The anger fizzes through me, overtaking my heartbreak and surprise.
It still doesn't mean you or Samantha are in danger, Nancy says. It might not mean anything at all, Coop adds.
Or it could mean that she thought someone was targeting us, I say.
Who would want to do that?
Coop asks. Lots of people, I say. Crazy people. You've looked at those crime websites. You've seen how many freaks out there are obsessed with us.
That's because they admire you, Coop says. They're in awe of what you went through. What you managed to survive. Not many people could have done it, Quincy. But you did.
Then explain that letter. There's no need to clarify. Coop knows exactly which letter I'm talking about. The threatening one. The scary one. It unnerved him as much as it did me. You shouldn't be alive. You should have died in that cabin. It was your destiny to be sacrificed. Whoever wrote it had used a typewriter. The keys had been struck so hard that, on the page, the letters looked like burn marks seared into leather. Every O was actually a zero, meaning that key was likely broken. Coop said this hint could possibly lead authorities to discover who wrote it. That was 2 years ago. I'm not holding my breath, especially since every other means of identifying its author have already been exhausted. There were no fingerprints on the paper or on the envelope, which had been sealed not with saliva but a sponge and water. The same goes for the stamp. As for the postmark, it was traced to a public mailbox in a town called Quincy, Illinois. That wasn't a coincidence. Jeff and I had been living together only a month when it arrived. It was his first real taste of what life with me would be like. I was, of course, hysterical to the point of insisting we had to move immediately, preferably overseas. Jeff talked me out of it, saying the letter was a very sick but ultimately harmless prank. Coop took it more seriously because, well, he's Coop, and that's how he rolls. By that point, our relationship had dwindled to a text or two every few months. We hadn't actually seen each other in more than a year. The letter changed all that. When I told him about it, he drove into the city to comfort me. Over coffee and tea at our usual place, he swore that he'd never let something bad happen to me, insisting on a face-to-face meeting at least every 6 months. The rest is history.
That letter was sent by a deranged man, Coop says, a sick man. But that was a long time ago, Quincy. Nothing came of it.
Exactly, I say. Nothing ever happened to the psycho creep who sent it. He's still out there, Coop. And maybe he wrote to Lisa or to Sam. Maybe he decided to finally take action. I look to Sam, who's reverting by the minute back into her old self. Her hair has fallen from behind her ears and now covers most of her face like a protective veil. Have you received any death threats? Sam gives a tiny shake of her head.
I haven't gotten mail in a long time. One of the perks of no one knowing where you are.
Well, they know now, I say. It was on the front page. A fresh wave of anger crashes over me as I think about Jonah Thompson and what he's done. My hands ball into fists against my will, clenching and unclenching, aching for the sensation of smashing against his jaw.
Did Lisa get any threats?
Coop says, leaning into the phone to address Nancy. A few, she answers. Some more worrisome than others.
We treated all of them seriously, even managing to track down some of the guys who wrote them. They were lonely cranks, nothing more. Certainly not killers.
So you don't think Sam and I could be targets? I say.
I don't know what to tell you, hun, Nancy says. There's nothing to indicate that's the case here, but it's better to err on the side of caution.
Not what I want to hear, which keeps the anger rising. I long for an answer, good or bad. Something definitive and tangible I can use to guide me going forward. Without it, everything is as murky as the fog that shrouded Central Park last night.
Isn't anyone else upset about this? I say. Of course we're upset, Coop says, and if we had answers, we'd give them to you.
I turn away, unable to see the earnest way his blue eyes try to offer comfort but reveal only uncertainty. Until today, Coop has always been something solid and strong that I could rely on, even when the rest of my world was tilting into oblivion. Now not even he can make sense of the situation.
You're angry, he says.
I am.
That's understandable. But you shouldn't worry that what happened to Lisa is going to happen to you.
Why not?
Because if that was a possibility, Nancy would have told us, Coop says. And if I truly thought someone was trying to hurt you, we'd already be on our way out of the city by now. I'd take you so far away from here that not even Jeff would be able to find you.
He would, too. Of that I have no doubt. It's finally the answer I've been looking for. And for a moment, it's almost enough to snuff out the anger burning in my chest. But then Coop looks across the table and fixes Sam with a blue-eyed stare.
You too, Sam, he says. I want you to know that.
Sam nods. Then she starts to cry. Or maybe she's been crying for a while and Coop and I just haven't noticed it. But now she makes sure we notice. When she sweeps her hair off her face, it's impossible to miss the tears slanting down her cheeks. I'm sorry, she says. The whole situation is really getting to me. I stay where I am, trying to discern if Sam's tears are real, which makes me feel awful for even thinking they might not be. Coop, though, stands and rounds the table, edging toward her.
It's okay to be upset, he says. This is a bad situation all around.
Sam nods and wipes her eyes. She stands. She holds out her arms, seeking comfort in the form of an embrace. Coop obliges. I watch him wrap his bulky arms around Sam and pull her against his chest, giving her the hug I've been denied for the past 10 years. I look away. I march into the kitchen. I take another Xanax and begin to bake. 17. I'm preparing the dough for apple dumplings when Coop finally makes his way to the kitchen. Bowls of ingredients line the counter in front of me. Flour and salt, baking powder and shortening, a bit of milk to mix them with. Coop leans against the doorframe, silently watching me combine the dry ingredients, then the shortening, then the milk. Soon a large ball of dough sits on the countertop, malleable and glistening. I form a fist and give the dough several rough punches, mashing it into an uneven heap. Gets the air out, I say.
I see, Coop says.
I continue to punch, the dough bulging under my knuckles. It's only after I feel the smack of countertop beneath it that I stop and wipe my hands. Where's Sam?
She went to lie down, I think, Coop says. Are you okay?
I offer a smile stretched as tight as a rubber band on the cusp of snapping apart. I'm fine.
You don't look fine.
Really, I am.
I'm sorry we don't know more about who killed Lisa yet. I know this is hard to deal with.
It is, I say. But I'll be fine. The mounds of Coop's shoulders droop, deflating, as if I've also punched the extra air out of him. I grab a handful of flour and sprinkle it across the countertop. Then I slap the dough onto it, sending up tiny puffs of white. Rolling pin in hand, I flatten the dough in long, hard strokes. The muscles in my arms tighten with each push.
Will you put that down and talk to me, Quincy?
There's nothing to talk about, I say. Hopefully they'll somehow catch whoever did this to Lisa and everything will go back to normal. Until then, I trust you'll do your best to keep me safe.
That's my plan.
Coop chucks my chin,
just like my father used to do. It was a common gesture when we baked together, and I invariably messed something up, spilling a tide of flour over the rim of a bowl or cracking an egg so poorly that fine bits of shell swam in the yolk. I'd get upset, and he'd squeeze my chin between his thumb and forefinger, lifting it and thereby steadying me. Even though it's now Coop doing the steadying, the effect is the same. "Thank you," I tell him. "Truly. I know I can be a handful, especially on a day like today." Coop starts to say something. I hear the pop of tongue on teeth as he opens his mouth, the word just starting to form. But then the front door opens and Jeff's voice fills the apartment. "Quinn? You here?" "In the kitchen." Although Jeff is surprised by Coop's presence, he does a good job of hiding it. I notice only a slight double take. It lasts barely a second before he comprehends the situation and realizes Coop is here for the same reason he's come home in the middle of the afternoon with a box of wine and two bags of takeout from my favorite Thai place. "I left work as soon as I heard the news," he says as he deposits them in the fridge. "I tried to call, but your phone went straight to voicemail." That's because my phone has been turned off the whole time I've been home. By now, the texts, emails, and missed calls are probably stacked so high, I'll never be able to sort through them. His hands now free, Jeff pulls me into a hug. "How are you doing?"
"She's fine," Coop says dryly.
Jeff nods at him, the first overt acknowledgement that he's even in the room. He turns to me. "Are you?" "Of course not," I say. "I'm shocked and sad and angry."
"Poor Lisa.
They know who did it, right?" I shake my head. "They don't know who or why. All they know is how." Jeff, refusing to let me go, turns to Coop again. My head remains against his chest, turning involuntarily with him.
"I'm glad you were here with them, Franklin. I'm sure it was a big comfort to Quinn and Sam." "I only wish I could do more," Coop says.
"You've already done so much," Jeff says.
"Quinn is lucky to have you in her life."
"And you," I tell Jeff. "I'm so lucky to have you." I press myself deeper into Jeff's chest, his tie slick on my cheek. He mistakes it for distress, which I suppose it is, and holds me tighter. I let myself be held, turning inward, Jeff's body edging across my field of vision, eclipsing the image of Coop staring at me from across the kitchen. Later, Jeff and I watch another film noir in bed. Leave Her to Heaven, with Jean Tierney as an obsessive, murderous bride. So beautiful, so damaged. When the movie is over, we watch the 11 o'clock news until a story about Jeff's case comes on. The police union held a press conference with the dead cop's widow, urging stiffer penalties for those convicted of crimes against officers. Before Jeff can grab the remote and switch off the TV, I get a split-second glance at the widow's face. It's pale, deeply creased, smudged with sorrow. "I wanted to see that," I say.
"I thought you'd want a break from bad news."
"I'm fine," I say.
"Just like Sam's fine. And Coop's fine."
Coop had left minutes after Jeff arrived, mumbling excuses about the long drive back to Pennsylvania. A clearly subdued Sam spent most of dinner trying to avoid the need to speak. And I remained mad, despite the Xanax and the baking and probably half the box of wine. I still am, hours later. It's an irrational, all-encompassing anger. I'm mad at everything and nothing. I'm mad at life. "I know this is hard on you."
"You have no idea," I say.
That's more than anger talking. It's the stone-cold truth. Jeff doesn't know what it's like to have one of only two people just like you snatched from this earth. He doesn't know how sad and scary and confusing that feels. I'm sorry, he says. You're right. I don't. I never will. But I do understand that you're angry.
I'm not, I lie.
You are.
Jeff pauses. I tense up, knowing he's about to say something I don't want to hear.
And since you're already mad, I might as well tell you that I have to go back to Chicago again.
When?
Saturday.
But you were just there.
The timing sucks, I know, Jeff says, but a new character witness has come forward.
I look at the television's blank screen, still picturing the face of that cop's widow. Oh, I say.
The guy's cousin, Jeff continues, even though I have no desire to hear about his client's character. He's a pastor. The two of them grew up together, got baptized together. It could really help his defense.
I flip onto my side and face the wall. He killed a cop.
Allegedly, Jeff says.
I think about Coop. What if he had been gunned down by this guy? Or what if Jeff's client had murdered Lisa? Would I still have to pretend to be happy that some niceties from a preacher cousin could reduce his sentence? No, I wouldn't. Yet Jeff seems to expect exactly that. You do know that, in all likelihood, he's guilty, right? I say. That he shot that detective just like everyone says he did.
That's not for me to decide.
Isn't it?
Of course not, Jeff says, matching me in testiness. It doesn't matter what he's been accused of. He deserves as good a defense as anyone else.
But do you think he did it? I sit up slightly, peering over my shoulder at Jeff. He's still on his back, hands behind his head, staring at the ceiling. He blinks once, and I can see the truth in that swift flutter of his eyelids. He knows his client is guilty.
It's not like I'm some expensive criminal defense attorney, he says, as if that makes it slightly better. I'm not getting rich from defending obvious murderers. I'm upholding a cornerstone of the American justice system. Everyone has the right to a fair trial.
What if you were assigned to defend someone really bad? I say as I flop back onto my side, unable to look at him.
I'd have no choice.
But he would. If his client were Stephen Liebman, he of the swinging knife, or Sackman Calvin Whitmer, he'd have that choice to say no. That men like them don't deserve defending. Yet I know deep down Jeff wouldn't make that choice. He'd choose to be on their side, to defend them, to help them. Even him.
There's always a choice, I say.
Jeff says nothing. He simply stares at the ceiling until his eyes grow heavy and eventually close. Minutes later, he's asleep. For me, sleep is an impossibility. I'm still too angry. So I thrash under the covers in search of a comfortable position. If I'm being completely honest, there's a part of me that's doing it just to wake up Jeff. To make him as sleepless as I am. But he doesn't wake as the clock moves from 11 to midnight, then midnight to 1. At 1:15, I crawl out of bed, slip on some dirty clothes, and tiptoe into the hallway. Light still peeks from under Sam's door, so I knock.
Come on in, Quinn, she says.
I find her sitting cross-legged on the bed, reading an Asimov paperback bent at the spine. She's changed her clothes, returning to the black jeans and Sex Pistols t-shirt of yesterday. Her leather jacket has been added to the ensemble. When she looks up at me, I assume she can sense my anger. She certainly knows why I'm there. Sam wordlessly leaves the bed and roots through her knapsack, removing a purse, of all things. It's a pleather monstrosity with short handles that can only be slipped to the elbows. Next out of the knapsack is a pile of paperback books, which Sam stuffs into the purse.
Here, she says, snapping it at me like a football.
I catch it, surprised by its heft. What's it for?
Bait.
I say nothing. I simply follow Sam out of the room, the purse's handles gripped in my sweaty palm, as we slip out into the night. 18. Outside, unseasonable warmth clings to the clear air, raw and oppressive. The heat of the day seeping into night. By the time we reach the park, I've broken into a sweat, my face slick and shining. Inside the park, it's so hot that most of the men we see have discarded their hoodies, content to prowl the park in sticky tight t-shirts. We nod to some of them when we pass, as if we're one of them, cruising the night for supple flesh. In a way, we are. There's no mist in the park this time. The night is almost brittle in its clarity. Blades of grass catch the moonlight, glowing white, looking like sharpened teeth. In the trees, leaves droop from their branches like recently hanged men. We choose a bench not far from the one we sat on last night. I can see it just across the way, a triangle of streetlight thrown over its seat. I picture me sitting there 24 hours earlier, nervously wanting nothing more than to go home. Now I scan the night-shrouded corners of the park. Every shadow seems to tremble with untold danger. I'm ready for it. Eager. See anything? I say.
Nope, Sam says.
She pulls the pack of cigarettes from her pocket and taps one out. I hold out my hand. Give me one.
Seriously?
I used to smoke, I say, when in truth it was only once and only after being goaded into it by Janelle. One puff made me cough so violently that she had to take it from me, fearful of inflicting more damage. Tonight I do better, taking two tiny half puffs before the first cough erupts.
Amateur,
Sam says, inhaling deep and blowing smoke rings. Show off, I say. I merely hold my cigarette while she smokes the remainder of hers, always on the lookout, our eyes never leaving the dark horizon of the park. How are you feeling? Sam asks. About Lisa? Mad? Good. What happened to her is so wrong. I think it was easier... I can't say the rest of what I'm thinking. That it was easier to deal with when we thought Lisa had killed herself. It's not something you want to articulate, even if it's true.
Do you really think someone's out to get us? Sam says.
It's a possibility, I say. We're famous in our way. Rather, we're infamous. Notable for going through unthinkable situations with our lives intact. And some people, like the sicko who drove to Quincy, Illinois, to send me that letter, might see it as a challenge, to finish off what others couldn't complete. Sam sucks in the last dregs of smoke from her cigarette. She then puffs it out, talking as she does it.
Were you ever going to tell me about that email from Lisa?
I don't know, I say. I wanted to.
Why didn't you?
Because I didn't know what it meant.
Now it means we might be in danger, Sam says.
Yet here we are, sitting in Central Park at an ungodly hour, just asking for trouble. Hoping for it, in fact. But I see nothing in the clear night. Only our street lamp-enabled shadows stretching across the path in front of us, dotted with the smoldering butts of our two cigarettes. What happens if we don't see anyone? I say. Sam jerks her head toward the purse still looped over my forearm.
That's why we brought that.
When can we use it? She lifts one drawn-on brow and smiles in spite of herself.
Now. If you want.
Quickly, we form a plan. Because I'm smaller and therefore an easier target, I'll stroll through the park alone, the purse a tease dangling from my arm. Sam will follow at a discreet distance, staying off the path, where it's less likely she'll be noticed. If and when someone strikes, we'll be ready to strike back. It's a solid plan, only mildly reckless.
I'm ready, I say.
Sam points the way down the tree-shrouded path.
Go get him, Tiger.
At first, I walk too fast, the purse swinging as I tear down the path in a hurried gait that would give even the most experienced muggers second thoughts. I move so quickly that Sam has trouble keeping up. Looking over my shoulder, I glimpse her far in the distance, skirting around trees and hurrying over the grass. After that, I slow down, reminding myself the aim is to look vulnerable and easy to catch. Also, I don't want Sam to fall so far behind that she can't rescue me if the need arises. Eventually, I settle into a nice, even pace and head south along the path that hugs the shore of Central Park Lake. I see no one. I hear nothing but the occasional car on Central Park West and the scuffing of my soles against the ground. To my right is a sliver of empty park, bordered by high stone walls. On my left sits the lake, its placid surface reflecting a smattering of lights from buildings along the Upper West Side. I've lost track of Sam, who's still somewhere behind me, creeping through the darkness. I'm alone, which doesn't unnerve me as much as it should. I've been alone in the woods before, in situations more dangerous than this. It takes me 15 minutes to make a loop back to my starting point. I stand right where I began, my skin slimy with perspiration and two damp patches under my arms. Now is a rational time to find Sam and head back to the apartment, to bed, to Jeff. But I'm not feeling rational. Not after the day I've had. A hollow ache has formed like hunger in my gut. My single pass through the park isn't enough to make it go away. So I set off on a second one, again walking beside the lake. This time, fewer lights reflect off the water's surface. The city around me is winking to sleep one window at a time. When I reach Bow Bridge at the lake's southern end, everything is darker. The night has swept me into its arms, wrapping me in shadows. With that dark embrace comes something else. A man, drifting through the park on a separate path 50 yards to my right. Immediately, I can tell he's not one of the prowling men looking for sex. His walk is different, less confident. Head down and hands thrust into the pockets of his black jacket, his progress is more amble than walk. He's trying hard to look inconspicuous and non-threatening. Yet he's watching me. I notice how his Yankees cap keeps turning my way. I slow down, taking half steps, making sure he'll be in front of me when our paths connect roughly 20 yards ahead. I long to check behind me and see if Sam has caught up, but I can't. That might tip him off, a risk I need to avoid. The man whistles as he walks. The nondescript trill cuts through the silence of the park, high-pitched and airy. I get the feeling he's trying to put me at ease. An attempt, innocent or not, to get me to let down my guard. Up ahead is the spot where our paths meet. I stop and mime rooting through the purse, making sure he notices. He has to. The purse is too big to miss. Yet he pretends not to see it, continuing his exaggerated stroll until he's on the same path, just ahead of me. He keeps up the whistling, trying not to scare me, trying to get me moving again. The Pied Piper. I start walking. 1, 2, 3 steps. The whistling stops. He does too. Suddenly, he's whirling around to face me. his pupils ping-pong around his sockets, crazed and dark. The eyes of an addict in need of a fix. On the surface, though, he's hardly threatening. Gaunt cheeks, body as thin as a broom handle. He's practically the same height as me, maybe even shorter. The jacket gives him some girth, but it's all show. He's a featherweight. The hardness of his face is amplified by the sweat slicking his high forehead and razor-blade cheeks. His skin is as taut as a drum. He practically vibrates with hunger and desperation. When he speaks, his voice is a sluggish mumble.
I don't want to bother you, okay? But I need some money. For food, you know?
I say nothing. Stalling. Giving Sam enough time to get closer. If she's even there.
You hear what I'm saying, Mama?
The silence continues on my end. I leave everything up to him. He can leave. He can stay. If he does and causes trouble, Sam will certainly strike. Maybe.
I'm real hungry,
the man says, gaze flicking to my purse.
You got food in there? Some cash you can give?
I look behind me at last, seeking out Sam's approaching shadow. She's not there. No one is. It's just me and the man and a purse that'll make him really pissed if he looks inside and sees it stuffed with nothing but paperbacks. I should be scared. I should have been scared this entire time. But I'm not. Instead, I feel the opposite of fear. I feel radiant. No, I say. I don't. I stare at him, monitoring his movements. Waiting to see the flex of an arm or the curl of a fist. Anything to suggest he's thinking of doing harm.
You sure you got nothing at all in there?
He says. Are you threatening me? The man raises his hands, takes a step back.
Whoa, Mama, I ain't doing nothing.
You're bothering me, I say. That's something. I turn, start to walk away. The purse dangling limply from my hands. The man lets me go. He's too strung out to put up a fight. All he can muster is a parting insult.
You're one cold bitch.
What did you just say? I spin around and stride toward him, pushing close enough to smell his breath. It stinks of cheap wine, stale smoke, and rotting gums. You think you're tough shit, don't you? I say. Bet you thought I'd quake at the sight of you and hand over whatever you wanted. I give him a shove that sends him rocking back on his heels. His arms pinwheel as he tries to maintain balance. One of his hands knocks against my face, so light I hardly feel it. You just fucking hit me! The man's face goes slack with shock. I didn't mean... I interrupt him with another shove, then another. When the man crosses his arms, blocking a fourth push, I drop the purse and start to swat at his arms and shoulders. Hey, stop it! He ducks away from my blows, dropping to his knees. Something tumbles from his jacket and plops onto the path. It's a pocket knife, folded shut. My heart seizes at the sight of it. The man reaches for the knife. I slam into him, hip against his shoulder, nudging him away from it. When he stands, I start slapping at him again, swinging wildly, hitting his chest, his shoulders, his chin. The man lunges forward, pushing back now. I fight him off, still swatting, kicking at his shins.
Stop! He yelps. I didn't do nothing!
He grabs a fistful of my hair and yanks. The pain tugs me into stillness. My eyes close against their will, lids dropping. Something flickers in the sudden darkness. Not a pain, exactly. A memory of it. Similar yet foreign to the one I feel now as the man pulls me backward. The memory pain explodes like fireworks across the backs of my eyelids, bright and burning hot. I'm outside. Near the trees,
Pine Cottage vague in my muffled vision. Someone else has grabbed my hair and is pulling me back while people are screaming. My fingers